It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. We've got a really fun show for you. Brian X. Chen from the New York Times is here. Brian McCullough from the Tech Meme Ride Home podcast. And Jessica Condit from Engadget will talk about the new Surface Go, the new MacBook Pros, a keyboard conspiracy at Apple and Amazon Prime Day. Is it really a good deal? It's all coming up next on Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 675, recorded Sunday, July 15th, 2018. This show does not care about humans. This Week in Tech is brought to you by LastPass. Secure every password-protected entry point to your business. Join over 33,000 businesses and start managing and securing your company's passwords today. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit. And by FreshBooks, the ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software that helps small business owners thrive. Try it free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/twit. And by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/twit2. And by ZipRecruiter. Hiring, ZipRecruiter has revolutionized how you do it. Their technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. They find great candidates for you. So try it free today at ZipRecruiter.com/twit. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. All right, this is going to be fun. I brought a panel of young people together to talk about the news. Brian X. Chen from New York Times. You're a millennial, right?
Hello.
We decided that Brian is the oldest millennial.
I really don't feel like I should count, but I guess I am.
Well, you're Mark Zuckerberg's age, which makes you a millennial, according to Brian McCullough of the Ride Tech Ride Home. He is the Tech Meme Ride Home. He is a host of that in the Internet History Show. It's great to see you again, Brian. Welcome.
Hello, hello.
And a newbie, so a fresh face, Jessica Condit, who is officially, absolutely a millennial.
Very true. I'm sorry.
It's great to have Jessica from Ars Technica, and I'm sorry. Is that wrong? Engadget. Idiot. I'm an idiot. I knew it was one of those.
No. Better than Ars Technica. Anyway,
much better. Much better. No, great to have you. Jessica covers gaming there, but covers all sorts of tech news as well. And it's great to have you. This is a good week for you all to be here because there are certain times in the tech that are toy store times. This was a toy store time, a time that you want to go buy something. Mm. And in the toy store, we have something from Apple and something from Microsoft. And I know you cover these, Brian, so you probably were fairly busy this week. The Surface Go is the first one that came out this week. A little teeny-weeny Surface to compete with the iPad. Does it?
I don't know. I didn't cover this.
You couldn't care less, huh? No. This is a $399. Well, it's in your wheelhouse. It's a $399 device that is the size of an iPad, has a special little mini-type keyboard. You can buy as an accessory along with a pencil and a mouse even if you want. But it's Windows 10, Windows 10S, although it can be upgraded to Windows 10 Home for free. And it's tiny. And I read an interesting interview with Panos Panay, who's in charge of products, chief product officer at Microsoft, who's of the opinion that the future of computing is teeny-weeny.
Isn't that Johnny Ive's conviction as well?
Really?
Is that what we said when netbooks were popular in 2006, or was it?
Yeah, didn't they almost kill the PC industry? But the difference is they were small, yes, but they were cheap and junky.
Well, I mean, this new Surface is about the same price as a netbook was back in the day, right?
That's true.
$400. Yeah. I don't know. Like, the Surfaces haven't been selling that well, right, compared to the iPad. And I don't know if the problem is really the price or the size. It's simply that people don't really want Windows on a tablet. Have you seen the stats for the Surfaces? Like they just generally don't do much for Microsoft. It's from what I last checked.
Interesting. But. Although I did note that both IDC and Gartner said the PC sales were up a small couple of percentage points.
But do we count it as a PC or do we count it as a tablet? Like, you know, it's...
One of them, I can't remember which one. One of them did count the Microsoft tablets and one of them didn't. And then one of them did count Chromebooks and the other one didn't. So it's hard to do an apples to apples.
Interesting. I would say tablets, if they run Windows 10 and you can add a keyboard, a mouse, and a pen, are computers. But then, well, so, absolutely, doesn't Apple say an iPad is a computer or replaces the computer? What's
they call
a computer?
It, they call it the future.
The future
of the PC. Is it? Do they call it the post PC device?
Yeah,
or something.
Post PC. That's
the future
right.
of the PC or while. Something like that. Yeah. Like, it's supposed to replace the PC. And then you back them up and you're like, well, you want to replace the Mac with that? And they say, no, we don't count the Mac as a PC, but the Mac is a PC because it's a personal computer. So,
yes.
And they're also, you know, upselling the iPad, but not so much the Mac anymore. You know, it's
well, that brings up the second product that came out this week, and that is new MacBook Pros, but not just any MacBook Pros. These have the butterfly key. They didn't change those. Everybody's worried about these. And they kept the touch bar, but what they really did with these is they upped the RAM. You can get as much as 32 gigs of RAM. And they put the latest 8th generation Intel processors in there, including the i9. They put high-end GPUs. They even announced a GPU from Blackmagic, an external GPU. They aimed these square at the professionals, and the price matches. They started, I think, $2,700, and I was easily able to configure one to $7,000.
With the 4 terabyte of storage.
How many did you buy, Leo?
I only bought one. And I couldn't. I choked at the 4 terabytes. That drive alone is, what, $3,000, Brian? Something like that?
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
really expensive.
But was anyone even asking for a quieter keyboard? That's my thing with this one.
No. You don't think
okay.
so?
I don't think so.
I don't know. Like, I never had a problem with mine. I've never heard complaints about it. Maybe I'm out of the loop, but...
Oh,
seemed,
God,
seemed a little strange as a highlight feature.
I thought I was complaining loud enough that even in Phoenix you'd hear me.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not alone. Right. There's 3 class action lawsuits. Those are more about the reliability of the
I was going to say,
keys.
So mm-hmm. here's
yeah.
the deal.
You know the conspiracy about the reliability.
Theory, right? What's the conspiracy mm-hmm. theory?
That this, it's a cover story that they've made the keyboards quieter. They've actually fixed, theoretically, mm-hmm. the problem with the keyboards getting dust in them. But because they can't admit that there ever was a problem because of those lawsuits,
right.
they can't say, oh, hey, by the way, guys, we fixed that problem with dust getting into your keyboard and ruining your whole computer. So they say that, hey, what we did is made the keys quieter because what they what I tear down or one of those guys, I fix it.
They said there's a right. little silicone thing in there to keep it clean.
Sort of like a dam or something.
Yeah, like a dental dam.
Right, so yeah. if you want to go that way, but what they can they have plausible deniability. They can claim, well, this little silicone layer is in there so that it dulls the sound of the typing, but it actually could theoretically functionally also keep dust out. So.
Yeah, that's the Gruber theory is. He says marketing wise, I don't think they would admit to a reliability problem in the existing keyboards. Legally, I don't think they should admit to it. So whether they've attempted to address reliability problems along with noise or not, I think they'd say, no, we just made them quieter. And I think you're right. I think iFixit's teardown, where they show this thin rubberized layer under the keycaps, presumably to keep crumbs and dust out from under there where they can cause problems, is exactly to do that, not so much to make them quieter. But it's interesting because neither Jessica, Brian X. Chen, you said the same thing. You don't mind how they sound.
No, not at all. That's never been really an issue for me. Like, in fact, I kind of want one of those mechanical keyboards that are super loud, like just to get that feedback. Mm-hmm. But I feel like, you know, like this never really been an issue where people complained about how loud the keyboard was. So it's kind of a distraction in some ways to say it's a quieter keyboard.
You are a
keyboard.
True millennial.
but let me ask you, Jessica. So, okay, admittedly, you and Brian say not noise, but don't you feel like the travel is really short on these? And it's you said you use typewriters where there's a lot of travel. There's also a lot of noise.
I have used. I don't anymore. My job would be very difficult with a typewriter.
I'd like to file a review for Engadget. Here's the...
Let me fax it in.
Let me fax it in. Do you mind? It feels to me when I use the Apple keyboard, I don't want to belabor this. People have heard me complain about it ad nauseum, but it hurts my fingers almost because it's such a short travel and it has such a hard stop to it. It's almost like typing on glass.
Such a baby boomer, Leo.
Oh, so sensitive.
What are you talking about, man? It's amazing.
Well, I'm with Leo. It's aside from dongle life, the thing that prevents me from having upgraded to the latest Macs is that keyboard.
Yeah.
It just feels like typing on glass to me.
Renee Ritchie, who doesn't mind the keyboard, has had three fail on him. So, I have talked to people. I mean, there is definitely an issue with stuff. You said, Brian,
wouldn't you mind it if three failed on you? I think I would mind it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
I wouldn't be happy, especially because until Apple's recent admission and willingness to fix these for free, it was $700 to fix it.
Right. Sorry, you were asking me a question?
You had some problems, though, but you were able to blow the crumbs out.
Yeah, I had to get some dust under, like, some of the keys, and I have, like, a can of air spray, you know, in a drawer somewhere, and I just sprayed it for a few minutes, and it's fine. So, okay. I don't know. It's like I have this mantra where I feel like a lot of people forget that you have to maintain your devices. You have to take care of them, even though, like, they have fewer and fewer moving parts as we get more and more advanced, you know. But you got to clean things. You got to blow air every now and then. You know, it's fine.
I kind of promised myself, because I did buy one of these for thousands of dollars, I will never eat over my keyboard.
Yeah, I never do that, for sure.
So you don't eat
your keyboard? No, I don't eat over the keyboard. Yeah. But
I think a lot of geeks do eat.
And the contrary argument would be, when was the last time you heard of keyboards failing en masse? So it's something that's been fixed for a long, long time that suddenly is broken again. So
here's the thing I'm going to throw this out and you guys can tell me I'm wrong. Because there's no way of knowing what Apple's long-term strategy is with Mac OS. And of course, Apple has been at pains to say, no, we're not merging iOS and Mac OS. Not that anybody said that they were. I think the larger concern, especially among pros, is that Apple's just lost interest in Mac OS. They make so much money on the iPhone that they just don't really care. They haven't updated the Mac Pro since 2013. But all of a sudden, we're seeing a story about the Mac Pro coming out next year. Last year, we saw the iMac Pro, which starts at, $5,000. This year, they didn't update the MacBooks or the lower-end MacBook Pros. They only did high-end, very expensive. Here's my theory, that Apple understands it needs Mac OS because you can't write apps without Mac OS, right? That's an important part of the ecosystem. Plus, they really like the buzz they get from professional photographers and filmmakers and artists using and musicians using Macintosh. And they kind of like to keep that going. But they don't want consumers to use them. My prediction, please tell me if I'm wrong, is you won't see updated MacBooks, Mac Minis, MacBook Escape. You won't see updated consumer inexpensive MacBooks, MacBook Air, because Apple's position these days is, no, if you're a consumer, use an iPad. That the Macintosh from now on is for creative professionals. Agree or disagree?
But the thing is that the professional community just complains very loudly that Apple doesn't understand the professional user anymore, which is that, like, you know, if they really understood professionals, they would probably have an SD card reader or, like, you know, more ports in the MacBook Pro versus, like, this USB-C everything kind of thing. And, like, they would sacrifice thinness for perhaps some better battery life with a bigger
battery. Or a better
keyboard. You know?
And
you know, the Mac Pro was obviously a flop, and Apple's admitted that, right? The big trash can thing that they had for a while. I feel like when I talk to videographers and other people, like photographers, they just feel that Apple's dropped the ball on professionals.
So this isn't enough to change their mind, you think?
You know, it's like I think already the perception of the MacBook Pro is pretty negative, and you know, given the keyboard concerns and also just things like the touch bar not really being that popular of a feature, I think it's kind of the Mac overall is just doesn't really seem to have a vision right now.
You're actually taking it farther than I was willing to take it. What do you guys think? I mean, Apple did trot out creative professionals with the release of this. They have a whole ad campaign, the new Behind the Mac ad campaign, which is all these creative professionals using Mac laptops. They certainly, when they brought Matthew Panzerino from TechCrunch in to show him that they were working on the Mac Pro, they said, look, we have all these real filmmakers and other creative professionals working at Apple to show us the way with the Mac Pro. They clearly want to impress the community. Go ahead, Brian. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
Well, so there's a theory out there that aside from whatever they might want to do in terms of integrating iOS and macOS, what they're really waiting on, the thing that's the big sea change that they want to make, is they want to go to ARM chips or maybe their own chips. And so not only this sort of move, like the fact that you were right, they trotted out all of the professionals. I think that kind of lends, in my mind, credence to the theory that there is a big sea change coming, especially to laptops, but they're not there yet. And so they've got to keep treading water. And so, you know, they tried out the professionals and say nice things to the professionals to try to keep them in camp. The thing that's the most mysterious to me is the MacBook Air, which has to be, I think they said this on the Vergecast this week, and I hadn't thought about this, but that has to be the most successful Mac of all time, wouldn't you think? Mm-hmm. And that thing is just left just dead in the water. And so why, I guess this comes into your theory, Leo, that why would they abandon the most popular consumer-grade laptop probably ever made?
Well, you could say it's the most successful laptop, and certainly was copied by everybody. But its sales are dwarfed by the iPhone's sales.
Now, but not back in the day. Well, by the iPhone, but yeah, sorry.
Welcome to today. That's my point.
Right,
you have a shiny object in front of you that has sold a billion, you don't care about a few hundred thousand MacBook Airs. It just isn't. Jessica, are you a Windows or Mac user?
Because of work, I use a MacBook Air. I have one of the last few, I guess. But otherwise, I would be using Windows, and I don't know anyone, like, that I talk to professionally or personally that's really excited about buying an Apple right now,
that's
honestly.
Yeah.
iPhone is definitely like the top one. I, you know, friends and developers I know have iPhones, but like there's not a lot of energy in terms of like Apple like laptops and stuff like that. So
Jessica, there's so many people I know that are talking, and I'm thinking I'm looking at a Surface Book 2.
Mm-hmm.
Cause like Owen Williams, do you guys know him? He went back to Windows famously, I think like a year ago, and he wrote a piece, right? It was before the July 4th about his Surface Book 2. And you know, this will bring us back to the Surface discussion. The argument that he made that really kind of made me think about it is he said, well, you know, you have your iPad to do certain things, but then you've got to go back to your main computer to do other things. But what the Surface Book 2 does is you pull the screen off, and that's still your main computer with all of your files and all the things you need. And so that was the thing that and he also talks about, like, you know, drawing on the screen, making notes. He's been won over by that. But that was the thing that really made me think, oh, yeah, what if my tablet also was my main computer?
Mm.
Like, I can see that being a super interesting and, you know, the Surface Book 2 still has some USB ports and SD card readers and things like that that I'm unwilling to.
Yeah, I do miss those ports, I got to say. Owen wrote just a couple of weeks ago, the Surface Book 2 is everything the MacBook Pro should be. Now, he wrote this right before the MacBook Pro was updated. I'm curious if he's changed his tune. I mean, I'm sitting in front of a Surface Studio, but I have to admit, if I had the choice, I'd far prefer you to use Mac OS. Maybe that's old-fashioned. I come from that era where, you know, people loved the Macintosh. Maybe that's just not reasonable anymore. I don't know.
It's cyclical. You know, people are getting frustrated with Apple taking away things from them.
I live in a bubble because, you know, we do a Macintosh show, which is for serious Macintosh enthusiasts. I for years was, oh, Mac is so much better than Windows. Of course, before Mac, I used Windows. But Jessica, you're a gamer, so From a gaming point of view, there's no question that Windows is far superior to Macintosh. And Apple continues, even with this $5,000 laptop, to ship the worst anemic Radeon graphics cards.
But in that case, like in terms of gaming especially, the mobile market is huge for games. It's exploding.
They own it on iPad and iPhone, right.
the App Store is just saturated, and they're making a lot of money there. So in terms of games, I mean, mobile might just kind of be where Apple's looking, and that might be their bread and butter there.
That's the problem.
They're not going to take over PCs.
It's really hard for a company when you have a hit as big as the iPhone. It becomes very difficult to do anything else. You know, Apple has the money and the resources, the skills, the talent to do more than one thing, but there's no incentive. I think the only reason the Mac is still around is because you need it to develop software for the iPhone. I really seriously think that's it. Jessica, move your mic a little bit closer because of the AC. I want to get you more on mic if I can. Right in that shot. Let's just see that snowball right there in the shot there. I want to see that. I didn't ask you, Brian McCullough. You look like a Mac guy. You live in Brooklyn.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I think I got my first Mac in 2006.
Whoa.
And you know what? You named the exact reason. When I was a kid in the 80s and 90s, and you would go to Babbage's to buy computer games, they would have shelf after shelf of PC games and one little sliver of a shelf for Mac games. Yeah,
and most of the time, those were bad ports by Aspire and other companies from the PC game. And they were 2 years after the PC game was already over. You'd get, oh, we just got BioShock. I'm so excited. It's kind of pathetic, really. All right. Well, it's funny. I thought this would get a rise out of everybody, but I think you've already written the obituary for Apple's Macintosh. It's over.
Is it?
Well, you told me it was, Brian X. Jen.
No, I just don't really think the pro community is the one to keep it like.
Well, who's going to keep it alive? Consumers?
Well, I think just given the fact that the iPad Pro is not the greatest replacement for a PC at this point, right? No one's like saying I'm going to get an iPad instead of. I mean, some people are.
And there's such diversity in the PC because so many companies make PCs. There's so many different kinds of laptops. There's two-in-ones. There's convertibles. There's ThinkPads. There's all kinds of different form factors. You can pick the one you like the best. And by the way, I haven't done it yet. I really should sit down and do a head-to-head comparison between the hardware in the new MacBook Pro and in a PC, but I would guess the MacBook Pro is more than 50% more expensive for the same hardware.
Yeah, I mean, the iPad Pro at this point has surpassed the MacBook Pro, hasn't it, in terms of
the pros were outrageous, yeah. Oh, that's sad. All right, enough of that. Let's take a little break. Jessica Condit, great to have you from Engadget. Senior editor, that means she's a big shot at Engadget, and her first time here, and so we really want to thank you for putting up with us. Brian X. Chen from the New York Times, I've heard of them, small paper out of Manhattan. He's lead consumer technology writer there, BX Chen on the Twitter. And from the Tech Meme Ride Home, its new daily news podcast. I hope you're all listening. What time does it come out, Brian McCullough?
5 o'clock Eastern.
So it's perfect for your ride home.
15 to 20 minutes. So, most people have longer commutes than that, but you can also listen to Leo.
Well, that's why we make our show so damn long. Because I figure you get in the car, you want to put on a podcast, and that you don't want to touch it again, however long your commute. So as commutes have gotten longer, so have our shows. We're now up to two hours. mostly because I can't shut up. Our show today brought to you by LastPass. I don't have to tell you about LastPass. I hope I don't have to tell you about LastPass. Passwords are a nightmare. They're the worst part of computing these days. And every website you go to, every app you install, they want a password. And of course, you know, the experts, the security people say each one should be long, strong, and unique. That's a lot of passwords to remember. Far too many for anybody to remember. So people do the wrong thing. They use the same password over and over again. They make them easy to remember, which means they're not very strong. And it's even worse if you've got a business and your employees have the keys to the kingdom, the logins to your website, your bank accounts, all of that stuff. Are they using bad passwords? Are they putting them on a sticky note on the screen? You got to protect yourself. That's why we use LastPass Enterprise, and every business should be. Protect password, protect every point. Entry point to your business with the best password management you can get, LastPass. Turns out 81% of all breaches are caused by weak and reused passwords. LastPass makes it easy to generate completely random unique passwords. You don't have to remember them. LastPass remembers it for you, fills it in for you. All you need is that one password to unlock your last password vault, and you are in. 13 million individuals trust LastPass, and about 33,000 businesses now. For easy onboarding, password autofill, mobile app access, LastPass makes it easy for businesses to take control of their passwords, reduce the threat of breach. I've been using LastPass since they started, and I've always loved it as an individual. We weren't using it at work, and that was a big mistake. We had an engineer put a web page up with all the passwords because he couldn't remember them. But it was a public web page. So that's when we started using that sounds like I'm making that up. It actually is the truth. So that's when we started using LastPass Enterprise. Now I don't have to worry. My employees, for instance, can get passwords to our QuickBooks, but they don't even know the passwords. They can't change the passwords. And without LastPass, they can't log in. We can make LastPass only work at work. We can make it you completely can restrict access to specific devices and locations. We can set master password requirements. We require two-factor. That's part of the deal. You can turn on password resets. An employee leaves. You can say, okay, everybody's got to reset their password. And you control it. Over 100 policies, access security reports, create shared folders. We have a folder just for engineers who need access to the website, just for engineers who need access to our accounts. I mean, it really, really is a great solution. And of course, LastPass makes sure that all the data is fully encrypted and decrypted. Only at the device level, data stored in the vault is never, never available. Even the LastPass, only you can access it. They have the LastPass security challenge. That's great. That tells you how secure your passwords are and shows you where you can improve. And then they have these nice one button update your password, makes it very easy to fix it. LastPass is available for everybody. Use it at home with LastPass Premium or LastPass Families for your whole family. That's really cool because you can share your passwords with your spouse. Lisa and I do that at home because, you know, she wants to know the Comcast password or whatever. I just have that all in the family folder. I also have her designated for something that LastPass calls emergency access. If something should happen to me, if I pass away, she can request access to my password vault. I really think that's important. I keep seeing stories about people who die and their loved ones don't have access to their bank accounts. They can't get in. They're frozen out. The emergency access is brilliant. It has a nice dead man switch. If she says, I want access to Leo's passwords, they send me an email and I have a set period of time. I can set that period of time to respond. I say, if I don't respond in a week, then give her access. I must really be dead or disabled. Or just senile. LastPass Teams for teams of 50 or fewer. And then, of course, LastPass Enterprise, what we use. It is the number one most preferred password manager at work, at home. Make it right. It's easy with LastPass. Literally, the first thing I install when I get a new phone, a new computer, I put LastPass on it right away. I use the plugins for the browsers. I use the standalone apps. LastPass.com/twit. LastPass.com/twit. Find the product that's right for you, and we thank them so much for protecting all our stuff at Twit. Jessica Connett, two Brians, Brian X. Chen, Brian McCullough, and me. We're talking about the tech news of the week. I think we're done with Apple and Surface. How about we move on? Amazon Prime Day starts tomorrow. Are you guys going to work like crazy tomorrow, Brian X. Chen? Is it going to be like nuts? Do you have a war room?
So the Wirecutter is going to do...
Yeah.
As you know, the Times owns the Wirecutter.
They do such a good job.
Yeah, so they're going to be looking at some of the best deals throughout the day. And by best deal, we mean not just the lightning deals that pop up, but they're going to compare like the price history to, you know, like what it used to cost and determine whether these sales are good deals or not.
In years gone by, they've actually said that's not a good deal. Like, don't buy that.
Yeah, because typically when they go through the thousands of sales, like, maybe only 4% of them are determined to be good deals.
That's so terrible.
It's definitely worth checking out the Wirecutter tomorrow. And I think Tuesday is also Prime Day, right?
Yeah, it's 36 hours. So they start 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, and they go through on Monday, and they go through all day Tuesday. I feel like it's amateur hour. Like I shop at Amazon all year, so I'm gonna skip Prime Day. Are you excited, Jessica? Are you gonna Do you have, you keep your eye out for an Instapot or something?
I mean, it's kind of like Black Friday. I don't really go out on Black Friday because, I can shop at other times. I can find deals at other times. And again, like the idea that they're not really even deals half the time. I hate feeling duped. So I kind of avoid Prime Day unless there's really something I have my eye on. I don't need an Instant Pot right now, so I'm good.
How about you, McCullough?
I feel like that Prime Day is still trying to rope people into buying on Amazon, like people that are like still buy things offline and things like that. And so I'm the wrong person to target because anytime I have a need, within 30 seconds, I've already bought it on Amazon. So yes. I'm not in the habit of shaping or waiting around for deals or things like that.
Yes.
So it's all about, to my mind, still bringing, if they still exist, although Amazon is apparently reaching, 5% of all retail sales at this point, convincing people to give Amazon a try. But then also, what I find amazing is how much, and you can't tell me that on some level inside the hallways of Amazon, they don't think of this. Not only is Prime Day great PR for them, but look at all of the other offline retailers that have to do deals now. Mm-hmm. This week to try to compete, and like so they win coming and going because everyone else has to kill themselves and cut their prices just to try to compete.
So according to CoreSite Research, no, Amazon doesn't say, but according to CoreSite Research, Prime Day may go to, they may have revenue of $3.4 billion in that 36-hour period. And sales are expected to shatter last year's record by 40%.
Holy cow.
40% becoming their new single-day record. Of course, people will watch to see if it does that. Prime is key to e-commerce for Amazon. They want people to become Prime members. And you're right. I think, Brian, part of the problem is they've saturated in certain economic groups, especially high-income people. They were adding 10 million subscribers to Prime. Again, they don't release these numbers, but analysts think they were adding about 10 million new subscribers a year for the last 3 years. But the real issue is now they almost have 100% of high-income people. They need to find new areas. According to Consumer Intelligence Research Partners, if you're a Prime member, you spend more than twice as much on Amazon, $1,400 a year compared to $600 a year for non-members.
You know, I think the smartest thing that they've done so far with Prime is Whole Foods, right? Like, like it's crazy.
For sure.
So the Whole Foods barcode or the Prime barcode that works inside Whole Foods gives you like 10% off whatever's on
sale.
Have
you used that?
Yeah. And also, like, I also have the Amazon credit card, which gives you 5% back at Whole Foods. So I get 5% and 10%. And
that's
all my money.
Good.
You guys locked me in forever. Mm-hmm. I'm going to shop at Whole Foods forever, and you're going to know all the information about what I buy, like both online and offline. It's genius, right? Like,
and actually, this will be the first Prime Day with Whole Foods, so you may see some
deals. Yeah, so they have
deals.
Like, it's 10% back for the credit card this week, or like today and tomorrow,
I
think.
Man.
Sorry, tomorrow.
I got to get me one of them Amazon credit cards. I see that every time I buy something on Amazon. They say,
yeah,
you know,
it's like no annual fee, so why not, right? If you already shop on Amazon.
Wow. See, I bet you are going to do something on Prime Day. You're going to go to Whole Foods.
Exactly.
That's true, actually. I'm going to do that, too. It's cyclical, right? It went from online to brick and mortar, brick and mortar to online to brick and mortar. Like, we're just going to keep going around until Amazon dominates all of it.
Ben Thompson at Stratechery says that Amazon's real mission statement would be to get 5% of all economic transactions, period. End of statement. Or some fraction thereof. Pretty brilliant.
I mean, pharmaceuticals at some point too, right?
They bought PillPack last week for $1 billion, but that puts them in the pharmacy, online pharmacy business.
Well, the $1 billion is not the headline. It was the $16 billion or whatever they knocked off the market caps of other people in
That's
the
right.
pharmacy space.
Yeah. That's right. Walgreens, CVS stock tumbled that day. Well, the same thing happened when they bought Whole Foods, right?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't supermarkets stocks freak out? So Whole Foods actually is, especially when Amazon got it, is not a strong driver. They hadn't been doing all that well. The sales had kind of flattened. So Amazon's acquiring Whole Foods now looks a lot better with Prime Day. Yes.
I mean, yes. For me.
Well, you just, yeah. But you made the case. And if you've noticed it, Brian X Gen, I would guess that everybody's thinking that, right?
I guess people of my shopping habits of like going to Whole Foods because it's like two blocks away from me. But
we call it whole paycheck around here. I would bet even after a 20% discount, it's still more than the other grocery stores. Yes.
Yeah, but it feels special because it's Whole Foods.
But you're special.
You don't get any discounts at Whole Foods.
Okay.
But what Jessica pointed out about it. Offline, going to online, and then coming back to actual physical retail. I mean, those Amazon Go stores, you can't tell me 10 years from now they won't be on every corner like Starbucks. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know?
Shouldn't totally. We be afraid of this?
Well, because the genius strategy is you create an e-commerce juggernaut, you kill everybody in traditional retail, and then you have all these empty storefronts that you can just move right into.
Yeah, I mean, that's why. I'll tell you why, Jessica. Because as soon as Amazon controlled all book sales and eliminated bookstores in communities all over the country, they jacked the price up. As soon as you control all sales, the price is yours to set. Now, I don't know if Amazon will become predatory. Probably they won't, because they're happy that they get 5% of all retail spend. Mm-hmm. That's mind-boggling.
Sounds like you have problems with capitalism, which is a different conversation.
I do. No, I worry because that is I do have a problem with capitalism, not garden variety capitalism, but that's what happens in capitalism. If Adam Smith's, hand of the market works only if there's competition, right? The breaking point of capitalism is monopoly. That's why we have antitrust laws, because as soon as a company can dominate, then there's supply and demand doesn't mean anything. Prices now can be anything they want because they have 100% of the market. Amazon has 49% of the U.S. e-commerce market. That's mind-boggling.
And yet Apple was busted for antitrust for e-books. Remember that?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I want to point out something, and I've been trying feverishly to confirm this or not. But so, 59% of the e-commerce market, but 5% of all retail spend is insane if that includes things like car sales, right? Because that's the thing that in other numbers like this, when they're talking about Amazon taking over retail and things like that, they always caveat, you've got to back out car sales because that would be such a huge percentage. But they're specifically using the words
retail.
Of all retail spend. So if that includes the car market as well, and they've gotten 5% of that, that's absolutely insane.
Well, how long until they start selling cars? They buy Carvana or something?
For all I know, they do.
They may own. I don't know.
Let me search for Lamborghini on Amazon.com. I wouldn't be surprised. Would you? And by the way, if they did, wouldn't you buy it from them?
If there was a Prime deal.
Yeah, two-day delivery.
Yeah. Well, is there a world where Amazon, owns a lot of our retail world, even in physical space, but there are also mom-and-pop shops? There's also a local market? Like, right. Is that a possibility? Because that sounds okay.
Yeah, don't you want those to continue? I do. I like that
idea. I like local stores.
I look at, though, we live in a relatively, 50,000 person community, so that's kind of mid-sized small town America here in Petaluma, and the downtown is all antique stores and boutique furniture stores, because there is a bookstore. I don't know how they survive, but everybody buys online, and there's no reason to have a bookstore. And now that Amazon's in groceries as well, look at this graph. This is a little bit scary. This is the top 10 U.S. companies ranked by e-commerce. Again, now this is the e-commerce part. Sales share. Amazon, that's the one where it's 49%. The next competitor, eBay, 6%. There's nobody even close.
Who shops on eBay? Sorry.
Yeah. Well, Apple's the next. Walmart, which has, Walmart bought Jet.com. It was trying to get into e-commerce. The Home Depot, Best Buy, QVC. Really?
I thought Macy's was doing well. I guess not.
Not Nika. This is e-commerce, right?
Oh, so.
Costco, Wayfair. Actually, the fact that Wayfair has 1.1%, they're very, I'm sure, very happy with that. That's hundreds of millions of dollars.
Like, I didn't even know that was a well-known brand at all.
Well, oh, yeah, the big e-commerce.
I bought a rug on there once. Yeah,
yeah, well, there you go. You see? Okay, so does it not worry you, Jessica, that one company would be so dominant?
No, it totally does. Like, that graph is scary. And I just don't know if it's the sci-fi dystopia. You know, it's easy to jump to that. Like, this is what this is going to lead to, and this company is going to control everything. Prices are going to be whatever. And yeah, like, we should definitely keep an eye on that. But I also see more of a movement for shop local, like these kinds of community-based awareness programs that are kind of popping up, and I really like that. So maybe it'll balance out in the end. I'm optimistic, I guess.
I at the risk of sounding like an Amazon apologist by jumping in a second time and playing devil's advocate, the article, the TechCrunch article that you had up, Leo, specifically notes that the main driver for Amazon at this point is their marketplace, is allowing other retailers.
Half of all those sales are from non-Amazon companies.
So even, I mean, the problem is that functionally, does anyone really know that? They think they're getting it from Amazon anyway. Amazon gets insane margins. The margins for allowing someone to use their warehousing and logistics and sell on the site is actually better for Amazon when Amazon sells a product itself directly. So on the one hand, I don't even know if I'm making a coherent point here. I am saying that Amazon's main growth is allowing other people to play e-commerce. But at the same time, again, does anyone know that? They just think they're shopping from Amazon anyway.
Well, you know who does know that? Jeff Bezos, who is clearly brilliant, now the richest man in the world by like $10, $20, $30 billion. If I put myself in his shoes, sure. I don't mind if everybody sells through Amazon. Then I don't have to warehouse it. I don't have to do any logistics. All I have to do is take a percentage of the transaction. That's exactly what he wants. I bet you he'd like 100% of all the sales on Amazon to be marketplace. Then you don't have to have a warehouse. Your life is much easier.
That's the point, is that they're charging the fees to use their warehousing to use, because they've already, it's a sunk cost. It's already, the warehouses exist. They built them.
Right.
So they can charge the fee for the warehousing and logistics that is actually, it ends up in the end, I've seen this several places, that they're making more money because at being a middleman for other people, being the we'll take care of all this stuff. You know, if you're starting a t-shirt company or you're whatever it is, and you don't, like, they can instantly give you worldwide scale and ability to serve any customer. And so if Amazon says, yeah, that'll be 15%, like, that seems reasonable.
Well, actually, worldwide is an interesting word there, because Amazon does not succeed very well outside the U.S. and they face huge competition from companies outside the U.S., particularly in China. What's the big Chinese company?
Alibaba.
Alibaba is bigger than Amazon, right?
I
think so. I wonder if you'll start to see each region have its own, you know, equivalent of Amazon. Why is it so hard for Amazon to do well outside the U.S.? Is it a U.S. phenomenon? Is it?
I mean, Chinese government is pretty anti.
That's a good one.
Big tech from
America. I bet you India has its own Alibaba, though, right? I bet you. I don't know.
Yeah, what's the name of that company? Although Amazon is specifically doing a big push in India right now, maybe because they know that they already lost the China market.
It's Alibaba versus Amazon in India, according to Forbes India. This is the battle zone for the battleground for Alibaba and Amazon trying to get a foothold in India. There is a Paytm that's I'm sorry, that's a financial services company. Paytm, Alibaba owns that. That's the other big thing in parts of the world where banks and checkbooks are not common. These digital payment services like M-Pesa and Paytm, those are huge. And another very nice way to make money. There you don't really have any. You don't have to worry about employees. It's all digital.
Do you know that mobile payments are pretty huge in China?
Are they?
Yeah. Like
using WeChat or?
They have like QR codes everywhere. Yeah. I'm not sure what app they use, but I mean, it's pretty much replaced the wallet. Like, people don't really use credit cards as much. It's mostly just mobile payments. Kind of fascinating.
I think flip Flipkart is. Isn't that the Indian?
Oh, Flipkart. You're right.
Yeah. Which probably Masayoshi Son has invested most of it anyway. So I don't know. I'm sure it's a local Indian company, but it's probably, or Alibaba has made major investments in that too.
Yeah, they've been in the news. I'm trying to remember the story. Amazon is also moving. You know, one of the big businesses Amazon has that was kind of came out of nowhere was Amazon Web Services, which is hugely profitable. They're totally dominant over competitors like IBM and Microsoft. They're now looking at making switches and selling network switches. So bye-bye, Juniper. Bye-bye, Cisco. Here comes Amazon. That's got to scare anybody. When Amazon says, you know, I kind of like your business.
I mean, that's pretty much their cash cow, right? AWS, more so than retail.
Right.
Yeah,
they're right.
Not making much not much money off Amazon.com, I think.
Right. So I didn't know this, but according to the information, Wayne Ma and Kevin McLaughlin writing, the switch data center switch business is a $14 billion a year market. What? I feel like this is the secret economy, the secret magic behind everything we're talking about here that nobody pays any attention to is data centers.
Infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. And you know, every transaction that you do is going through dozens of computers it's the cloud. That's the problem with the word cloud. It hides all this stuff. Mm-hmm. It is, though, fascinating, mm-hmm. isn't it? And people like you guys who are infrastructure experts, man, you guys... You got the keys to the kingdom. I'm pointing to some of our audience members who work for a little company in Mountain View that does a little bit of this stuff. Facebook is what's the deal with Facebook? Where do we stand with Facebook? You haven't been hearing a lot about Mark Zuckerberg lately. Is he high? Is he laying low after his congressional testimony? His testimony in the EU.
He should be, right?
He's just saying, I'm done now.
He's dodged so many questions that he doesn't want to be seen in public right now, I think.
He's hoping everyone forgets about all of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they have something new. This is if you're buying eyeglasses from Michael Kors, for instance, on Facebook, you'll be able to test them on your face with augmented reality, kind of like Snapchat, but for real products before you buy.
That's not very new.
That's not new?
No. I think Gilt did that before. You know?
I think you're right. And I've seen hair salons do it with hairstyles.
Yeah.
Jessica, can you try tattoos out before you buy? Wouldn't that be cool?
You can. It's called a pen, I believe.
just a little Sharpie.
Butterfly.
Yeah, just every day. Uh-huh.
Let me see how do I like that?
Face tattoo. Yeah.
I'll point out, Leo, that they're not exactly laying low. I mean, they did get fined for the first time for the Cambridge Analytica stuff. Was that last week, this week?
Yeah, I saw that. It was the biggest fine the EU could give, which was like a slap on the wrist.
Yeah.
$500,000 to Facebook? That's nothing.
Dropping the bucket.
But yeah, I guess it's All right, so they got fined. What else? Anything else? Any other?
Their head of comms left, right? Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
That was like a few weeks ago, and that's kind of significant because... Like, everybody agrees that they handle the Cambridge Analytica scandal quite poorly in terms of, you know, communicating with the world and the press. And I don't know if there's causation with that episode, but Elliot's gone. Elliot was his name, right?
Schrag.
Yeah.
He came from Google, didn't he? Yeah. He was head of global communications and public affairs at Google.
Speaking of Google, John Giandria went from Google to
Apple.
Facebook.
Or Facebook, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he's going to be in charge of...
chip development or something like that?
Yeah.
And it's fascinating to me that, like, it seems that Facebook and Google are both ahead of Apple in terms of AI and machine learning and these kinds of real future aspects. So, again, I don't know where Apple's future lies, right? And I don't think it's AI either, so...
Apple has combined the Siri team and the machine learning team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they poached that AI guy from Google.
Yeah, right? John Giandrea. Yeah. And so he's going to be in charge now of both. You got to figure Apple's saying, we don't want to be left in the dust here.
Well, I guess
they kind of are right now.
They really are, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the question with Apple, so they want to take a a strong stance on privacy, right? And the question is, do you need to store information about people in the cloud to have good AI and, you know, like kind of aggregate all that versus like, you know, Google and Facebook are obviously doing that and so far ahead. But can Apple catch up to them if they stay committed to privacy and not collecting your information?
But see, I think that's the opportunity. You know? And Apple's done something interesting with iOS 12 because they do want to beef up Siri. But they don't want. They do want to be known as the privacy company, right? So that seems like conflicting.
Yeah, but they say that they do it all on the phone, right? So like Siri Suggestions is a new like AI tool in iOS 12, and it's supposed to be studying like what you do to make suggestions, like, hey, maybe you should turn off the phone because you're having dinner right now, or something like that, like Do Not Disturb, right? But can it really be that smart if they're just doing everything using data from your phone versus like the cloud and the collective whole of like people's behaviors and patterns or anything?
I think they've actually done a little sleight of hand, because one of the things Siri Suggestion uses is what your apps know about you. So instead of Apple knowing anything about you, they palm it off on, and they use this as a demonstration, the Pete's app, right? Every time I drive by Pete's, I stop for a mint mojito. Remember they demonstrated that?
Yeah.
So the Pete's app is paying attention to your location and what you buy, and then signals Apple this would be a good thing to do. So Apple, in effect, says to Siri, well, we're not going to collect information, but we'll let the apps on your iPhone collect information, and then we'll use those to make Siri smarter. I thought that was quite a clever little sleight of hand, actually.
Yeah. Did you see – oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Did you see that story from 2 weeks ago, or maybe it was before the 4th, about how they're, you know, rebuilding Apple Maps from the ground up?
Yeah.
And you know, sorry, they admitted that they're going to use data from everybody's searching on maps on iPhones and things like that. And they go back and forth 1,000 times in the articles I read about this, saying, no, trust me, it's anonymized. We're using your data, but we're not going to know, you know, all this stuff. But the thing about getting AI systems better and machine learning systems better is you need data. It's recursive. So the more data you can feed these systems, the better they get. So it's sort of like, and I know we could, it's a whole thing about the cultural differences between different companies and things like that. But, you know, Google and Facebook, they have nothing but reams of data. And so the engineers there, to them, it's just natural to use those things. But it does... The question will become, when you have to do something and make a big system like Apple Maps better, you have to use the data that's available to you. I mean, I'd rather Apple bend over backwards to make sure that they're protecting privacy and things like that, as opposed to just using it. But I don't think Apple, if they're going to compete in AI, you know, like Jessica's concerned about, you got to use the data that your users are collecting. Are generating.
Apple says, and this is really interesting, because I think that they completely understand this challenge. And what they told Matthew Panzerino from TechCrunch is, well, what we do is we don't take the beginning of your trip. We don't take the end of your trip. We just take anonymized stuff from the middle of your trip that could be anybody. There's downsides to that, though. They don't know the entrance to a building, and they have other ways of figuring that part out. Hmm. I think if Apple really applies itself and its creativity, knowing that its mission is, I actually really find this fascinating. Its mission is to keep its users private. That's a big selling point for iPhone users, to protect their privacy. Can we do something intelligent? And I think if they apply, and that's why I find it interesting that they hired Gianandrea, who has a pretty good track record at Google with this stuff. Maybe they'll fail. You know what? Maybe you can't. But I'm glad somebody's trying. It's almost as if you had somebody in the ad tech business say, hey, could we, you know, customize ads without collecting dossiers on everybody who uses Facebook? Could we somehow do this? I would just applaud them doing it, even if they just found out 5 years in, well, no, it's not competitive. I want Apple to at least try.
Yeah, I mean, I think an argument can be made that it's kind of lazy to just collect everything.
Yeah, it is lazy. It's the easy thing to do.
Finding a creative way to gather data and make use of it, right?
Yeah. I think maybe Apple can do it. I think it's really important that we all keep our eye on Apple, and that when they claim things like we anonymize the data, it really is anonymized. And we've seen many times where so-called anonymized data, in fact, doesn't end up being anonymous, because it turns out data tells you a lot about people, that they really are, you know, doing what they say they do. Apple's pretty good about publishing white papers and explaining in a technical fashion what they're up to. I think that's important. We need to demand that of them. But I also want to encourage them to try. And so I guess that's the pat on the back that I hope that they get, which is good for you on trying. We'll keep an eye on it. Make sure you really do that. Don't end up being lazy. But, boy, it would be nice, wouldn't it, to have a phone that you could use that didn't track your every move, or a social network you could use that wasn't building a dossier on you that they were happy to hand over to any government that asked.
But do you think average people care as much as we
no.
do? And that's the thing. It's like, no.
That's why it's our job.
So others can get away with being lazy, right. And Apple can keep trying harder, but people might not care. That's kind of the issue, kind of the challenge, right?
I think people care to the degree that it's a selling point for Apple. It is a good marketing point for Apple.
I think so, but yeah. I also like think that, you know, like my mother-in-law like doesn't even think about this stuff for a second.
No, but I bet if you asked her, like, which company respects your privacy? Which phone is safer to use? She would say Apple.
She actually doesn't care at all.
She doesn't care at all.
Anyway, okay. Average people, you know.
Yeah.
Very different.
Jessica, are you muted? Are you speaking?
Oh, I am. Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay, hi. Yeah, my fan is going, so I'm trying not to be loud.
Oh, I don't mind. No, that's fine. We can handle it.
Well, AC's on full blast, yeah.
It's hot.
It's hot.
But no,
how hot?
I think
Wait
we
a minute.
Saw...
How hot is it?
It's over 100. I stopped counting after that, you know, just jump in the pool.
I spent 2 weeks in Phoenix in the summer in an unair-conditioned apartment, and I broke up with that girl. So
yeah, don't come here during the summer. Everyone's mad.
Angry. So mm-hmm. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, just I think we saw how little the average person cares about these kinds of privacy issues. Like there'll be a lot of uproar online when something like the Facebook Cambridge Analytica scandal breaks, but then no one really dumped their Facebook account. You know, there wasn't a big culling. So I just wonder, yeah, if we're a little more invested in these kinds of issues than the average person.
Actually, Jessica, right now you're experiencing a cooling trend in Phoenix. It's a mere 99 degrees, but next Sunday it'll be 111.
So, yeah, we've had monsoons recently, which is very exciting.
I saw your pictures on Instagram storms. of the mm-hmm. rain. Holy cow.
It's crazy.
I thought you lived in the desert.
Yeah, I know. This is what happens. It's awesome. We have the hugest storms, and my dogs are very excited about it.
Is it happening right now? Is it raining? Is it raining
No,
right now?
I think there's someone in the hallway.
Oh, yeah.
So
that's
very
it.
Scary.
That's it. Let's take a little break. More to talk about. Jessica Condit is here, senior editor for Engadget. Brian X. Chen. He's in charge of gadgets. Oh, I'm sorry, consumer technology at New York Times. But you didn't write about the Surface Go. Isn't that consumer technology?
Don't write about everything.
Oh, you have to write about everything, Brian X. Chen. Come on, don't be a slacker. And, of course, Brian McCullough, the other Brian from the tech meme Ride Home. How many years did you do the Internet History Podcast? You still do that?
Still doing it. I think it's 5 years now.
Yeah, wow.
I think we've done 175 episodes.
How do you repeat? Like it's January 11th again?
Oh, it's not based on days.
Oh,
it's literally based on what I'm interested in. John Giandrea is a guy that I've wanted to get on for years because he goes back to Netscape. He was one of the early Netscape people.
You want me to make you jealous?
Okay.
On Triangulation on Friday, there's a new documentary out about General Magic. Mm-hmm. We're going to speak to the director of it. And, of course, that's where Giandrea was, along with Andy Hertzfeld and Bill Atkinson. Tony Fadell was there. Andy Rubin was there. It was
Piero Midyar was there.
Yeah. It was an incubator for some of the most interesting and best ideas in Silicon Valley, even though it was a complete flop. So that will be a fascinating documentary, and we're going to talk to the director of that on Friday. I'm looking forward to that. We had a good week this week. Actually, do we have the special video that we made that on our own very own little computers? Here's a video of some of the things you might have missed if you missed anything this week on Twit.
Previously on Twit.
Ron, after you mentioned the phones on The Expanse, then I started watching The Expanse.
My only complaint about The Expanse phones is because they're not real.
Yes.
Right?
They are.
Everyone holds them by like the edge.
Yes.
Because the rest of the phone is all CG. It looks like this very delicate thing that they're about to drop all the time. And it's like,
Windows Weekly.
If you are considering buying the Surface Go, do not buy the base configuration.
Oh, good.
jump forward directly to the higher end configuration. The types of normal human beings that you might think would be fine with this lower end configuration are not going to be, because those types of normal human beings are going to want to run normal applications,
right?
Which include such things as Microsoft Office, Google Chrome, Apple iTunes. Don't cheap out on this thing. I think this is going to make a humongous difference.
Mac Break Weekly.
If law enforcement carries a camera connection kit with them at all times, they apprehend somebody and they plug in that camera connection kit and then put it in a bag so he can't erase it, then they will still have unlimited time to access the contents of that phone.
Based on how it operates right now,
it's sort of like a severed arm at an accident scene. We're going to throw it in a bucket of ice.
I think this wins as being the most gory conversation we've ever had on Mac Break.
Twit, making the world safe for technology.
But we did have cupcakes. Our show today brought to you by FreshBooks. Streamline your business operations with FreshBooks, the easy-to-use cloud accounting software built for the small business owner, the freelancer. That's when I started using it, when I was freelancing back in 2004. I might have been one of their first customers. It's right when they first started. I was complaining about every end of the month I had to do invoicing, and sometimes I'd put it off, and then I wouldn't get paid. And oh, man, it's one of the worst parts of freelancing is doing the books, right? You didn't get into, unless you're a bookkeeping freelancer, but for most of us, we got into it for other things, but you still have to do those invoices and those books. FreshBooks made it so easy. By doing your invoices, make it really easy to do your invoices, beautiful looking invoices that make it easier for your customers, your clients to pay you, you're actually beginning the process of doing accounting without doing accounting. It will automatically connect to your bank account, update expenses daily. You can import them in bulk. You can even take a picture of a receipt, upload it, let FreshBooks add that to your expenses, maybe even add it to your expense report so you can get paid back in the invoice. You'll keep tabs of your business no matter where you are. FreshBooks mobile app is awesome for iOS and Android. And then, so now you have the invoices. That means you have accounts receivable. You have accounts payable. You have accounts paid. You have your expenses. Guess what? You've got your accounting done without even doing anything about it, just kind of in the process. It is so fantastic. For the first time ever, I knew whether I was making money or not. You know, you'd find that out when you had paid your taxes at the end of the year on April 15th. You go, oh, I guess I didn't make any money this year. There's no need to chase clients for payment anymore because you can accept online payments directly from your invoice, which means, incidentally, you get paid an average of twice as fast. See, clients think paying in bills, you know this, paying bills is as much of a pain as making bills. But if you make it easy for them, they're going to pay you faster. You can always see which invoices have been sent, but also which ones have been viewed, paid, overdue invoices. Import clients from a CSV file if you've got them. Bill for time by client and specific project. If you've heard me talk about FreshBooks before, you notice they keep adding new features. That's one of the advantages of FreshBooks. It's a web-based application, so it's always getting better. They now have a revenue streams graph that lets you know exactly where your invoice and non-invoice revenue, which might include online sales or ads, things like that, is coming from, so you can plan for growth, make informed decisions about how to diversify. They now have integration with Microsoft Outlook payments. That means it's even easier for users to pay your invoices from Outlook. 24 million people have used FreshBooks to painlessly send invoices, track time, capture expenses, and then getting back to doing what they love. Shouldn't you take a look at FreshBooks? We've got a 30-day free trial for you. FreshBooks.com/twit. Enter This Week in Tech in the How Did You Hear About Us section, if you will. That way we'll get credit, and you'll get 30 days free. FreshBooks.com/twit. Jason Howland, All About Internet, was talking about future phones. Really interesting article in the Washington Post this week by Jeffrey Fowler on the new smartphones. I don't know if you saw this, Brian X. Chen. This screen is something that I think this is made up, but Samsung is looking at a flexible screen that, you know, kind of opens up in the phone to make a kind of giant sized screen, almost a tablet. There's phones from he refers to sci-fi too, and the foldable device from Westworld, which is somewhat like this. But also, this is rumored to be the next phone from the camera startup Light. That's the company that makes that 16-lens camera. This is a 9-lens camera. They're in a circle on the back. I guess it's more than a rumor since this prototype comes from Light. this would be a way to turn a camera and a phone into something that is as good as a DSLR. Some of this is made up. Some of this is real. I think there's a genuine interest in creating some of this. This is a prototype Y-charge adapter that lets the phone charge just by sitting on a wireless table. Of course, iPhones could do that with Qi charging. I'm still waiting for my local bar to get a Qi charger. And, of course, there's Magic Leap's headgear. This was an interesting article about the future of technology. How much of this is just BS sci-fi? How much of it's actually going to happen?
I mean, people have been talking about flexible screens for a while, and I think one of the big challenges is batteries, and, you know, batteries are really delicate.
Inflexible.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And when you make a flexible battery, you have to make it pass all these different safety tests in order to bring it to mass market. And so people have been talking about this for years. It is really interesting, though, and I really hope that it happens at some point, you know, especially the flexible aspect of, like, being able to put it in your pocket with having a bigger screen, things like that. What else was in the article?
How about this light camera with multiple lenses?
I mean, that seems more realistically coming sooner, I think, like, because phones already are becoming more and more DSLR-like.
Yeah.
And
I have that P20 from Huawei that's got three lenses.
Yeah. So I feel like the camera is one of the parts that they can innovate on currently, you know, in the near term, because you just do more to the lens and do more of the software. It's kind of where all the innovation is happening right now, especially with the iPhone X and the front-facing infrared camera.
These will never be large sensors. They'll never be great glass, but they don't have to be. If you've ever seen the Pixel 2, what it does with what is essentially a pretty crappy image, but then computationally turns it into among the best images any camera phone can get, it's all in software. That's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
Any interest, Jessica, in a bendable phone?
Well, you know, honestly, like, yeah, we've kind of seen these prototypes before. We've seen this idea around. I think it's really cool looking. I think it could be really useful. I think it'll be a while till we get to an actual, like, book phone. But I'm actually, more excited about the cameras, because where I see, I mean, our phones and all of our mobile devices really connecting is in AR. And that's where we get, you know, Magic Leap and all that too. But the camera is really important when it comes to, you know, filming your environment and then putting things on top of that. So I see cameras being increasingly important in phones as we go on, yeah.
Although, some analysts think that Samsung will do this new phone, start manufacturing it in the fall. It won't. I don't know if it'll be an S10, or some people are saying it'll SX, but one analyst says it will cost almost $2,000. Now, how much would you pay? This is that seems a little. I don't know. I'm not sure why this is a Korean Times story that says the non subsidized price would be anywhere from $1,850 to $2,000, partly because of these screens, the 7.3-inch OLED screen, 4.5 inches folded, 7.3 inches when opened, might be pretty pricey. Samsung has shown these for years.
Well, then again, the iPhone X is $1,000, and so is the Samsung Galaxy Note. It's like $950 or something. And
don't you think phone manufacturers were watching with interest to see how the iPhone X?
Yeah, they're testing the price sensitivity of people.
Will people pay that much? And they did.
Yeah, because they're doing monthly payments, like installments, instead of the upfront payment.
I think also there's the sense that this is now my computer. And I was willing to spend $1,000 for my laptop. So why not for my phone? This has become my primary computer. And if you want that kind of functionality, I don't know if the iPhone X is worth what it's. Somebody asked me yesterday, we were answering a question about should he get an iPhone X, and I said, no, get the 8. I'm not a
big isn't that just the OLED screen that makes it so expensive?
Yeah, and I don't think Face ID is all that good. It doesn't work in enough places that it's kind of annoying.
Well, I think the iPhone X is obviously better, right? It's indisputably better than the iPhone 8. It's just that most people are not used to not having a home button yet, right? So I think in the near term, I would probably tell people to get the iPhone 8, but they're eventually going to have to lose a home button anyway.
Right.
And move on.
Are you a 10 user?
No, I'm waiting for my 2-year upgrade thing, so probably the next one.
Yeah.
But
What phone do you use, Jessica? See, I have to find out all the hardware you use, so I'm putting this in your dossier.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Yeah, finally get it right.
Yeah.
No, it's a Pixel XL. Ah. I'm waiting for my upgrade, too. I'll probably see if I can get the 3.
Yeah, I think this phone will see something pretty amazing from Google. The Pixel 2 felt like it was an interim device. It didn't seem that modern. I really like it. I mean, I really like the camera. The screen, I do
not. The camera.
Yeah, the screen really wasn't very good. Mm-mm. But maybe they'll fix all that in the Pixel 3. I'm hopeful. Emmy nominations are out. Now, normally we don't talk about the Emmy nominations on tech shows, but this time we do because Netflix got more than HBO, 112 Emmy Award nominations on Thursday. That's more than any other television network, breaking the streak that HBO held on to for 17 years. And we've heard a story, and maybe it's been a little bit debunked, but that the new owners of HBO, AT&T, came in and said, "You guys, we need to look more like Netflix. You're doing too few shows. We don't need hours per week. We need hours per day of viewing."
You know, Peter Kafka came out with the actual transcripts of that, and it did sound less horrible. But I think what everybody reacted to, because I did instantaneously, and we did on the Tech Meme Slack right away. We were just like, oh, no, they're going to destroy everything that is beautiful and great about HBO.
Isn't it credible, though? I mean, HBO made money. Mm-hmm. But isn't it credible that they would want HBO to be as successful as Netflix?
It depends on what you think strategically they want to do, because what everybody's trying to do is create an OTT streaming service to compete with Netflix.
Over the top, an internet-based streaming service.
Now,
AT&T is in the cable business, in effect, because of U-verse.
Or the pipes business.
They're in the pipes business because of AT&T, but they also own DirecTV, so they're in the So they are in the premium TV business. And you could argue the reason they bought Time Warner is because they wanted to have content so that they could eventually be an over-the-top business, right?
And also, don't forget, Leo, you know, everybody's betting on 5G being the thing that, like, you know, it's this game changer that maybe you wouldn't pay your cable company because 5G would be so good that it would kind of be a wash. But so the point I was going to say is, so if strategically you think that that's what they want to do, they want to people are hoping that there will be Netflix and then somebody else, maybe the Disney OTT, maybe AT&T's OTT. Well, then what you would do is you would lead with HBO, right? So
make that HBO's traditionally been kind of the boutique-y business,
exactly.
Right? We handcraft one great show every season that everybody's going to want to watch, like Game of Thrones or Westworld or Sopranos. And we let Netflix throw all the spaghetti against the wall all at once.
Exactly. So I think what everyone reacted to, and which I think still stands as a concern, is that what he was saying is he's like, you know, we need to do more things, more content. We need more, you know, 10-minute shows, 15-minute shows. We need more shows, more shows, more shows. I don't think that that's a bad idea. And obviously what they want is the same level of data and people in terms of people's, you know, watching habits and tastes and things like that. But don't lead with that. Do that in the background. Leave HBO alone. Ride its brand to create your OTT service, and then quietly introduce all the other changes that you want to do, and then no one will care. But I'm still concerned that if this is the attitude they're taking, and they're riding into town, showing up at HBO, and saying, "Guys, everything's going to change," that would have me worried.
Yeah. Every time a big company like AT&T buys another company, the story always is, oh, you're going to be autonomous. We're not going to change you. We really love what you're doing. I remember when Tech TV was sold to Comcast. That's exactly what they said. We bought you because we love you. They didn't love us. And I guarantee you, AT&T will tell HBO, oh, you know, we bought Time Warner because we love all of their products, and we certainly aren't going to change anything you do until next year, when we're just completely fire everybody and start all over again.
I mean, I think on a really superficial level, if I were HBO, I'd be worried because Game of Thrones is ending soon and Westworld is not that good, right?
Yeah.
It's just kind of a terrible show. It's only season 2. And
okay, we can get a little nerdy here. I know you're doing a book about nerds, Brian McCullough. What the hell was Westworld? I really was excited about it.
Jumped the shark so fast, right?
It just, the last episode, I thought, oh, well, this will all come together.
Don't spoil it too much. I haven't finished.
You haven't seen it yet? Okay.
Not all of season two, yeah.
No spoilers.
I keep falling asleep. I love season one. Season two can't
fall asleep. Then you're not going to keep watching HBO.
There's a problem.
Do you know, do you guys know the Ringer guys? I think it's Andy Greenwald and can't remember the other guy. They do a podcast called The Watch or whatever. And I really buy into their theory about the show, which is that the show fundamentally doesn't care about humans.
About you.
About you or humans or having any of their characters have an interesting... It's more interested in the machinery. It's almost like... And maybe this is a smart thing to do. You know, Lost convinced everyone that what you want to do is make a show for Reddit. Make a puzzle show that everybody... And it's succeeding on that level. But it's not succeeding
if you do
all.
What Lost did and you didn't don't resolve it, prepare... Right, But the wrath of Reddit.
All of the pieces fit for Westworld. What doesn't work for Westworld is I don't care about any character on that show at all.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder,
No, please.
But I think HBO has shown its interest in like kind of picking up maybe smaller shows like High Maintenance and stuff like that and making them its own. So I wonder if maybe we'll see some YouTube stars heading to HBO or like some podcasts being turned into shows or I don't know.
That's like, exactly what they're going to do. Yeah. And that's what will completely destroy HBO.
It's possible.
And I say that as a podcaster, not as a YouTube star. But I have to say that's exactly what happens is these companies go, oh, we don't know what the hell. Why is it people watch? Get a YouTube star. And the thing is, it's never worked because YouTube is its own sui generis. It's its own thing. And stardom on YouTube is fine on YouTube, but it never seems to translate to anything else. And the same thing with podcasts too, to be honest. I really feel like HBO should just stay HBO and try to... I read an interesting... I guess it was a Twitter stream. This is a really sounds far afield, but it's going to make sense. Talking about Elon Musk's submarine that he made to save the kids in the Thailand cave. And, I know what it was. It was Zeynep Tufekci's article in the New York Times.
I saw that today, too. Yeah.
Where she says, you know, this is really an interesting contrast between Silicon Valley's, you know, let's jump in and let's fix it. And let's throw money at it. We're the smartest guys in the room. We can solve anything versus the slow safety mentality that makes airline travel so safe these days. The idea that you develop expertise, you're careful, you're cautious, you think about it, you don't rush in, you're not the smartest guys in the room. And that has, in the long run, proven a better thing. That's what saved those kids. When Elon's submarine wouldn't even have worked. We're going to talk a little bit about Elon because he seems to be going off the deep end with this whole thing. I feel like that's exactly the kind of thing it's the HBO versus YouTube mentality. And that HBO is very much old school, cautious, great writing, careful filmmaking. They still do one thing, though, that Netflix doesn't do. And this may be the big differentiator. They release shows 1 week at a time. That sucks.
Mm. But you're just telling Brian not to do a show daily.
No, that's a different... That's a podcast.
Okay.
That's a different thing.
Fine.
But wouldn't Westworld have been better if you could have binged it?
If all of the shows go to binge, then all of the podcasts and blogs and recapping sites, you're going to destroy an entire industry of media.
Well, I'm sure that's HBO's point of view. Just as you said, you craft a show for the Reddit community, and you give them a week to chew on it. I don't get the sense that that helped Westworld at all.
But I feel like it helped Game of Thrones a lot.
It did.
The hype wouldn't be there for that show, I don't think, with a binge format.
Do you think that House of Cards benefited from being binged versus... Because it was a Netflix show. And in fact, the reason I asked that is the producer, Dana Brunetti, we interviewed him, and I've known him for years, and... he said, we were about to make a deal with a big cable network. I'm pretty sure it was HBO. And Netflix called. Reed called. And Reed Hastings said, we'll write you a check for $100 million today to put it on Netflix. And Brunetti said, okay. And he called Spacey, and Spacey said, yeah. And the thing that put him over the top wasn't the $100 million. They could have gotten that from HBO or whoever they were talking to. It was the
release it all at once thing. You, for a whole season, you produce it all and then you release it all. And for some reason, they preferred that model. I'm not sure why. I didn't ask them that question. But I know as a viewer, I prefer that model. I hate it that I have to wait a week.
Well, this is why Netflix is kicking ass, right?
Jessica, have you seen the Indian episode where it's just the Indian guy?
No.
Oh, see, this is what was cool about Westworld. There were individual episodes that were really, really nice. Mm-hmm.
It's just in season two, yeah.
In season two. So but the whole thing didn't hold. Oh, you haven't seen anything in season two?
No. I've seen like 2.5 episodes, but I probably watched through episode 4, but I just keep...
I know why you fall asleep. The brain does that. When it's confronted with something it can't figure out or understand, it just...
Or care about.
Or care about. It just goes up.
Again, the show does not care about humans. It thinks robots are watching it. Yes.
Mm. Well, that's the problem. Humans are watching it. It may be about robots, but humans are watching it. All right. Yeah, Zeynep's article is kind of interesting.
You saw that Elon responded to her directly on Twitter. Yeah. Oh yes, because that's what we're going to talk about.
Oh, my God. I guess we might. Let's take a break, and then we'll talk about what the hell's going on with Elon. Because I'm thinking I'm not buying another Tesla after this. Honestly, I was that affronted. Our show today brought to you, we'll talk about it in a second. Our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Let's talk about the biggest expenditure you're going to make in your life. The most important. The biggest check you will ever write. It's that new home. That's a big deal, right? And it's a stressful time. One of the things that makes it stressful, of course, is getting the loan. The other thing that's making it stressful these days is, as you're house hunting, the interest rates are going up. And there's pressure. We go, let's just buy this house because I don't know how much it's going to cost us to buy it in a month. But it takes a while to get a house that you really like. This is where Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans really can make a difference. They want to do something about it. And this is exactly the kind of thing you'd expect from the best mortgage lender in the business. Rocket Mortgage, we've talked about it before. They have something they call the power buying process. Here's how it works. Quicken Loans is going to verify your income, assets, and credit. They'll do this in less than a day. And you'll get verified approval, which, by the way, right up front is great because you're basically a cash buyer. From the point of view of the seller, if you've got a loan approval, that means they don't have to worry. They know you're good for it. But then this is when the best thing happens. When you're verified, you qualify for Rocket Mortgage's all-new exclusive Rate Shield approval. They'll lock up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. There's no anxiety. Rates aren't going to go up. In fact, they might even go down. If the rates go up, your rate stays the same. If rates go down, your rate drops. Either way, you win. Exactly what you want. Trust me, as somebody who's done this a few times. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/twit2. That's rocketmortgage.com/twit. And the number... 2. Rate Shield approval is valid only on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, and MLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. It's rocketmortgage.com/twit2. Elon has deleted some of the tweets that he put out today.
What'd they say?
Yeah, that's the problem with Twitter, right?
I miss them.
You can always, nothing is deletable. So it started when a British diver named Vern Unsworth did an interview in which he was asked, what do you think about Elon Musk's idea with the submarine?
Sticky submarine where it hurts.
He said, you can stick a submarine where it hurts.
Just had absolutely no chance of working. He had no conception of what the cave passage was like. The submarine, I believe, was about 5'6" long, rigid, so it wouldn't have gone round corners or round any obstacles. It wouldn't have made the first 50 metres into the cave from the dive start point. Just a PR stunt.
But he went into the cave Tuesday.
So this really affronted Elon. Now, I, by the way, I don't blame him because I'm going to give him credit. He leapt in. He said, look, we want to get these kids out of the cave. I'm going to send engineers. We're going to build this thing. If it helps, it helps. If it doesn't, no big deal. But at least he did something, right? But when he saw this tweet, this interview with Vern Unsworth, he kind of went crazy. He really didn't like the notion that it was a PR thing. He fired back, never saw this British expat guy who lives in Thailand at any point when we were in the caves. The only people in sight were the Thai Navy Army guys who were great. Thai Navy SEALs escorted us in, total opposite of wanting us to leave. Then he says, he goes on and on. He says, the guy's a pedophile. You know what? He says, we'll make one of the mini sub pods going all the way to Cave 5. No problems. No problemo. Sorry, pedo guy. You really did ask for it. Then somebody said, please delete that. Calling someone a pedo is not cool. Somebody else tweets, Elon, you should try inventing a device that prevents you from using Twitter. By the way, I would buy that device. Elon deletes those tweets, although he at one point said, bet you a signed dollar it's true. It started a couple of weeks ago with an analyst call where Elon kind of went off on an analyst, maybe reasonably, because the guy was asking him whether, you know, he was ever going to be able to make all those Model 3s and so forth. He shut him down. He seems to be getting a little wilder, though, each time.
Yeah, speaking of PR, I know people on the PR team at Tesla, they say working with Elon is just hell.
What a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, like, the guy just says whatever he wants. He's out of control.
He could be president. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that.
You know,
I'm out of control. Stop me before I tweet again.
I feel that ultimately Elon is just doing the guy thing, right? He's not sympathizing with this Thai rescue team and like what's going on over there. He's trying to solve their problem by sending a submarine over there, and that's not like really what people need, right? It's just typical guy thing.
Yeah.
The cover story of Bloomberg Business Week this week is all about the crash attempt to get to 5,000 Model 3s produced. And he apparently cooperated with it because there's quotes in there about that. But like, it goes into all the details of, you know, him doing production in a tent. They put up a tent outside to try to, you know, and the quotes from him are, I've been sleeping under the desk and all that sort of. Is it possible that the main problem, aside from, okay, maybe he's been going through a lot because, you know, maybe Tesla is really, you know, having a hard time in a crunch period. They could be running out of money. What if the problem is that he can't stop doing things?
Yeah.
He can't delegate. He sees these kids caught in a cave and he's got to help them.
I got to get in there. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is sometimes the rap on him, is that while he's a genius and certainly willing to take chances and think big, he shouldn't be managing these day to day, that he should leave professionals in charge and then go off and do the vision thing. I don't pretend to know. You know, for a long time, I was one of those guys who thought he was, Tony Stark, that he was Iron Man, that like Elon was the guy, the hero we needed.
There's still a lot of people that think that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like I was at South by Southwest this year and he made a surprise appearance. Like he just kind of showed
God,
up.
Right.
Tickets were sold out within hours, and it was standing ovation. It was everything he said. It was like Musk for president of Mars, all this stuff. It was strange to see. Yeah.
Zeynep writes in the New York Times, this is an opinion piece, I should point out, what Elon Musk should learn from the Thailand cave rescue. Instead of venting Mr. Musk, indeed Silicon Valley as a whole, could perhaps see the Thai operation as a lesson. This was a most improbable rescue against the longest odds. The Silicon Valley model for doing things is a mix of can-do optimism, a faith that expertise in, this is the key one, that expertise in one domain can be transferred seamlessly to another, and a preference for rapid, flashy, high-profile action. But, she writes, what got the kid and their coach out of the cave was a different model, a slower, more methodical, more narrowly specialized approach to problems, one that has turned many risky enterprises into safe endeavors, commercial airline travel, for example, or rock climbing, both of which have extensive protocols and safety procedures that have taken years to develop. This, quote, safety culture, end quote, model is neither stilted nor uncreative. On the contrary, deep expertise, lengthy training, the ability to learn from experience is a valuable form of ingenuity. She says that's what helped Sully Sullenberger to land that airplane on the Hudson River in 2009. But that's, by contrast, Silicon Valley moguls seem to favor spending money on improbable but impressive sounding long shots. You can't say that's not true. She talks about Mark Zuckerberg's gift of $100 million to the New Jersey schools that did nothing to improve them. If Silicon Valley wants to help the world, she concludes, there's a lot it can do, starting with making its own products safer and its own companies more just. Perhaps more important, it can develop a respect for hard-earned expertise in areas other than its own. That's an indictment. I think that's probably what started Elon Sunday off badly.
I mean, I think it's a pretty strong argument in that. I mean, if you look at Tesla as an example with the autopilot causing...
A lot of hubris there. I mean, I keep my hands on the wheels all the time.
I mean, of course, like Tesla framed it as like the driver's fault or somebody else's fault or whatever. Yeah. But I talked to someone who does self-driving cars and he's still working on it. But his argument was like, how many cars have autopilot on the road right now? And what is it like? Three cars out, like three people died from it. That's pretty bad odds, yeah. Right? And you got to like consider that just because three is a small number, it's not necessarily a great argument for this failing, you know, and that people are basically beta testing auto driving software and dying.
It made me think twice about it. I use it. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
But what it seems to be the case is that sometimes it gets confused and actually like dives off the road. There was this one case up here and that it just practically dove off the road, killing an Apple engineer. So I really pay it. I use it, but I use it as if like at any time it could fail, drastically. I do notice that when GM with their new Cadillac and Nissan with their new Leaf put these kinds of self-driving technologies in, they're much more conservative. The old school car companies, for instance, GM has this feature in its Cadillac CTS, I think it is. We drove it the other day. But it only does it on highways it's mapped. It won't even do it on city roads, even though it could, and certainly the Tesla does. They're a little more conservative.
Yeah, for sure.
And I kind of think that might be the right way to go. And certainly naming it autopilot was a lot of hubris. I mean, that's what gets people into trouble, right? That's what gets somebody in the back seat napping while the car is driving. Not a good idea.
And it's quite a level of hubris when, despite these deaths, I think, didn't Elon recently say, like, autopilot's going to be available to everybody, enabled.
Any day now. Yeah, right.
In the next software update or something like that. Anyway.
You know, Leo, not to provide you with a good segue to a different story here, but...
Brian. You know I want it.
The analogy is Google with their moonshots. You know, like it's a very engineer's view of the world to think that because I was so smart to solve this incredibly difficult problem, that I can solve another problem. And the story that I'm alluding to is Google's X division graduating, as they say, a couple of their moonshot companies this week. But if you think about it, like, so, you know, Larry and Sergey have wanted to change the world for 20 years now, and they've wanted to evolve Google beyond simply making 98% of their money from advertising to something else, anything else. And they haven't been able to do it for 20 years. And I'm not saying they won't, and I'm not saying that that's hubris or whatever, but it's not easy. And just because you are a genius and you solve one insane, difficult problem, I think Zeynep's most cogent point was that doesn't mean that you can do everything.
Yeah. And have some respect for other processes that might work better. Yeah, still, I mean, nobody these days needs to be convinced that the Silicon Valley culture can be toxic. Right? We all have learned that lesson.
I mean, did you see the story about Elon Musk's fanboys who were defending him on Twitter and trolling that journalist, Aaron Biba?
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Toxic.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and that's the other thing. Elon and everybody else, get off Twitter. Nothing good will come of it. is there anybody listening who hasn't said something really stupid on Twitter? Because it's almost like a stupidity enabling machine. Have you ever, Jessica, regretted a tweet?
No, because I've deleted them by now. So I'm going to say no. Yeah.
Do you use Tweet Delete? I delete my tweets every 6 months or something.
What? Oh, that's brilliant.
Do you really?
Yeah, exactly.
I've been meaning to sign up for that.
Oh, I got
to
do that.
I only allow my past years of tweets to be remaining.
It's not that you think that there's anything in there that's damaging.
Right. I don't think that there's anything there incriminating. It's just that why does there need to be an immortal timeline of everything I've said? That doesn't benefit anybody. It's not like I have a record of history in my timeline, you know?
I say this all the time, and nobody ever agrees with me, but I feel like that a lot of the woes in this in our society today come from the fact that it's really easy, especially with Twitter, but other technologies too, to say something without any thought that you would, you know, in an earlier time with Jessica's typewriter would have taken, you would have had some time to regret it, some time to think about it, some time to step back from the cliff. But Twitter, it just encourages this visceral, instantaneous response that is more times than not a mistake. No, maybe not. Maybe it's just.
Well, and one thing I see it doing, like, I wouldn't say that Twitter and these kinds of services have exacerbated any problems in tech, any problems with ego at top levels of major companies. I think it's just exposing it more than that. It's exposing a lot of things. Oh. And in that sense, it's kind of a positive, but it's also, there's no response to it, right? It just kind of exists now. And we're figuring out how to deal with that.
This is where my age distinguishes me from the rest of you guys, because I'm old enough to have been covering technology at the beginning, the onset of the consumer access to the internet, and to be of that generation like John Perry Barlow that was very optimistic about this and way over, it turns out, foolishly and way over optimistic. We really thought that the internet would democratize speech, that yes, of course, bad guys would get the chance to speak too, but that sunlight would disinfect, just as you said, Jessica, by making it be more public, all the bad ideas would come out and then we could throw them out and move on from them. And foolishly, it's a shame, and it makes me sad because I really was we were all in the early 90s, very optimistic about what this internet could do and how it was going to change the world. And it's done some of that, but it's also done some stuff that we didn't anticipate at all.
But it's also interesting to look at the next generation of people that are using the internet. You know, like, some of us are millennials, but the people who are even younger, they're all using Snapchat now, you know? And it's
smartly,
like,
because it doesn't live.
Yeah, right? Yeah. It doesn't, like, it's not immortalized. And they have, like, these shadows of social media, right, which eventually just disappear. And can I segue into my story?
Yeah. Right?
So I only am thinking about this because I was writing about Apple's screen time feature. You know that,
yes,
that new feature in iOS 12 that's coming out in the fall. It's basically acknowledging that some people have addiction problems. You can monitor the amount of time that you use on the iPhone, and you can set limits, like a time limit for Snapchat or Facebook or whatever. And once you run out of time, it kicks you out of the app. It locks you out. You can't use it anymore. So I wanted to test it on myself because I think I'm a compulsive phone user. I pick up my phone every 5 minutes.
Who isn't?
Pretty much all of us are.
This thing is highly addictive.
Yeah, and I wanted a teenager to test it on. So I don't have a kid, but I borrowed my boss's teenager for about a month.
Or as you call him, a screenager.
Screenager. But
her, I should say.
Yeah, so I installed the iOS 12 beta on an iPhone 10 that I loaned to her, and I watched her app usage for about a week to see like how her phone usage was in general. And she was using the phone like 6 hours a day, which is a lot, right? Like, and her peak was like 8 hours a day.
Wow.
And, you know, that's like our 9-to-5 schedule, right? She was using the phone like all day. And I found that kind of crazy. I told her boss about that, and my boss about that.
Her boss. Yeah, right.
And my boss just flipped out, you know? Like, she was sending all these text messages to her daughter. She was like, what the? Why would you, like, spend 7 hours on the phone?
You busted her.
And, like, you were, like, looking at your phone at midnight.
You busted her.
Get her.
And what's fascinating, so, like, even immediately before, I mean, immediately after I set the time limit for Snapchat, because that's what she was using the most, her phone usage dropped to 4 hours and 44 minutes on average per week. And then by the third week, it dropped to 3 hours after these limits kicked in. And
now I'm worried.
Like,
let me look at mine.
Oh, are you using iOS 12?
Yeah. Now I'm really worried. You say that your screen time on average...
Mine is 3 hours and 46 to begin with.
3 hours and 46. Now, before I look at mine, in my defense, I want to point out, I've been playing a lot of Pokemon Go lately. Okay?
Are you still playing that game?
I came back to it. It's got even better.
It's much better now.
Isn't it?
I understand completely.
Yes.
Yeah, totally.
And I have 200 friends, so Ooh. I've got to accept a lot of gifts. But Jessica, for you, I'll kick one of them out and let you be my friend.
Oh, you're sweet.
where is it that I would find out?
You go to
Screen Time All Devices.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, last 7 days. Oh, good news! I've only spent 29 minutes.
Okay, that's wrong, but it's kind of buggy.
Oh, you know what? It restarted probably today.
Oh, yeah, because it's starting the week. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Pokemon Go is number one. Followed by my Reddit app, Narwhal, then Hangouts, Instagram. But this is like such a small amount of time that I don't think it Venmo's. Venmo? How much time can you spend on Venmo? 9 minutes, it turns out. I pick up the phone 12 times a day. But this was, this is only, I don't know what's going on here. It's only for one day.
Yeah, I think it's probably off because you didn't set it up before picking it up right now.
Okay. But I did turn off downtime. Because you know why? I don't like to be told what to do. And it was telling me, you've Instagram, you've used this too much. You're not using it. You've been using too much. Get out of here.
I set a limit for social media for myself for 1 hour because I found that I was using Twitter for like 4 hours a day or something, three hours a day.
Yeah.
And yet I post like on Twitter maybe once a week or something, like two or three times a week.
You're consuming it.
So I was just lurking on Twitter, just reading people's.
That's the only way to use Twitter. That's the safe way.
I guess so, but it was just a waste of time. I wasn't doing anything productive.
It is a waste of time,
Yeah. But even after I did that, I found other ways to waste time on the phone. I kept checking my banking app to see if any more money was magically
appearing. Do I have any more money?
For no reason.
No, not yet. Any more money now? No,
not yet. Oh, God, what gives?
Where's all my money? I should be rich by now.
I kept on checking. I kept on reloading the same websites, like the New York Times websites over and over. Like, what's going on with Trump?
Compulsive.
What's going on with Trump,
Isn't that interesting how compulsive we get in the using of these devices?
Yeah. Yeah, so it's like, at the end of the day, so what's funny is a teenager spent less time on the phone than I did at the end of the experiment. Like after 3 weeks, she cut down to 3 hours, and I was still...
Once she knew what she was doing, it was solely that, or was it her mom yelling at her?
It was a combination of her mom yelling at her, and I set the limits for Snapchat, Safari, and something else for her.
Interesting.
I think games.
And
she was also just very disciplined because she was asking for more limits. She actually liked it. At the end of each week, I checked in with her, and she was like, can you add another limit for Netflix? Because I'm wasting too much time on that.
Wow.
So do you have kids, by the way?
I do. They're all adults now, though.
Oh,
so
okay.
I can't. I don't no longer have control of them.
Yeah, I just wonder how this is going to turn out when this releases in fall and whether parents are going to have as much success as I did with their teenagers, because I know that a lot of people feel like it's a problem for their teens right now. And, at least in this experiment, Sophie, the teenager, was fantastic.
You should check back on it with a few weeks, though, and see if she still likes it, right?
My kids aren't quite this old yet, but Brian, so wait.
Yeah.
How do you set your kids, the limit? Like, you have to go into their phone physically, or is there like a parental control over other devices, iOS devices?
I'll just back up for a second. So when you set up screen time, you can set up a family account as well. So you can be the parent. You set yourself up as a parent, and you can add people as your kids. And because they're your kids, you can add the restrictions, including screen time. So in that case, you can see their statistics in the same way you see your own, and you can add limits after you see them.
That actually is great.
Yeah, I think it's really great. It's really buggy right now. I wouldn't use it until fall, but I think the concept in general is awesome. I think people are going to like it a lot. It's going to be pretty hard to bypass because you need a passcode to bypass the when it locks you out of the application, for example.
Wouldn't it be funny, though, if next week you look at Sophie's and her most used app is screen time?
Like looking at her screen time?
Let me refresh that.
Wouldn't it be funny if they updated it and you could get an electric shock delivered to the client?
There is a device. Well,
I got to say, I think that was a flawed study because you didn't have Fortnite installed on either of your phones.
Oh, that's a good point.
And I think that would skew the results a little bit, yeah.
That's a good point. Jessica, would you ever put something like... You can't, fortunately, on your Pixel, but would you ever put something like that on?
I have enough little games on there. You know, Pokemon Go is making a resurgence, so I'm set for now. I don't do Fortnite, so no. If they got Overwatch on a phone, I would do it.
God, can we talk about Fortnite? I hate Fortnite.
Oh, Fortnite's awesome.
Oh, God. I just tried it a few days ago with my fiance's brother and other brother. Anyway, we were playing as a group for the first time, and it's just such an agonizing game, right? Because, like, they just drop you into the deep end. They don't teach you how to play it at all.
No.
You're surrounded by all these teenagers who are just really, really good. Yeah. You run around for 20 minutes not knowing what the hell you're doing.
20 minutes? I get about three.
Yeah, and you learn the controls.
You're doing really well, Brian.
And you finally see somebody, and they just destroy you. You're dead. And it's probably a 15-year-old, right? But what a horrible experience. There's, like, no onboarding, you know? There's just, like, you just have to expect to learn how to play by getting your ass kicked over and over. But
that's
anyway.
Called gaming.
That's no, like I mean,
most
it,
gaming
honestly.
Is like you. Most gaming, you have a little sandbox where you're on a little tutorial or whatever. They teach you how to play the game.
No, but Brian, I mean, Jessica can speak to this way more than us. But I mean, that's what any of those online. If I mean, going back to Call of Duty in 2010 or whenever, when I was obsessed with that, like that's all it is. If you jump into it, you're gonna jump into the deep end and you'll get killed forever.
Did you see that the in the World Cup, one of the French players, Antoine Griezmann? Does a dance from Fortnite when he scores a goal. He does the L dance. Do you know that dance, Jessica, where you put your, you do this and you kick your.
They have so many different dances.
I know.
Yeah. I just assume any kid dancing is doing a Fortnite dance at this point.
Nowadays, yeah. That's probably the case.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm horrible at Fortnite. I admit it, but I'm never going to get good because that's how they just drop me in.
I'm not good at it.
Yeah, no, it's fun anyway, right?
No, it's not fun to run around for 20 minutes and get gunned down and then lose.
By the way, I'm trying to find video of Griezmann doing this. But
I really enjoy watching Fortnite on Twitch. So that's what you need to do, Brian.
Yeah. Don't say Twitch.
Twitch.
Say Twitch.
Twitch.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Do me a favor. I'm looking at all the tweets, and it's all been pulled down because FIFA is really, really good about getting rid of FIFA video on Twitter. God. Yeah. So part of the fun of it is that you can continue to watch the game after you get greased in Fortnite, which happens to me instantly. I get to watch the person who killed me, right? And then you watch the person that killed him, which is a little bit of satisfaction. Then you watch the person that killed that guy, and all the way up to the end of the game, you get to watch the whole game. I think that's kind of, to me.
Well, that's esports.
That's so boring.
Well,
that's everything.
And that's kind of what, Jessica, that's exactly was my experience. For a long time, I thought, wouldn't you rather play a game than watch somebody play a game until Fortnite? And then I realized, no, this is really fun. I think Fortnite is single-handedly, among all the other things it's done, including make $150 million a day on iOS alone, selling nothing, virtual goods, a funny dance, a costume. It's also going to be the best thing that ever happened to esports. Not because it'll all be Fortnite, but because people will suddenly get that it is fun to watch a game to the end.
Yeah. I mean, esports, I think, are a lot like VR, where you really have to experience it firsthand to understand it. Like, you have to put on a VR headset to really understand how awesome VR can be.
Yes.
And you have to be invested in at least one round of one game and see someone play through till the end and feel that excitement to get esports. So it's, like Twitch is huge in terms of introducing people to these kinds of experiences. Yeah.
And I think Fortnite is actually the game that is going to convert a lot of people. It converted me. Then I watched the Fortnite, what was it, the esports thing they did at E3. Mm-hmm. And it was so much fun.
Yeah. It was cool.
It was like, wow, this is great.
Can't believe you play Fortnite. What kind of baby boomer are you?
You know, I got to tell you something, Mr. Young Brian X Chen, born in 1984. Good Lord, I have ties older than you. I think it's a common misconception that gamers are all young guys. I think that gamers are all kinds. And in fact, I think there's statistics that show that most gamers are men in their 40s and 50s.
I thought the Fortnite players were like 9 years old, though.
That's true. It's getting younger in that sense. And then most mobile gamers are actually women. So
that's right. Pokemon Go. That's where I go to meet women. They all look the same. But, you know. No, I actually, my wife and I have been playing Pokemon Go. It's kind of sad. We were We were on the 4th of July. We went up to a small town up north in Mendocino, and we're wandering around town, and we're playing Pokemon Go because it's got a lot of Pokestops and gyms. And some woman walks by. Now, you know, we're an older couple. Some woman walks by and says, "Smell the air. Look around you. Life is happening." "Yes, Mom." Jeez. These old people just don't get it. But Pokemon Go is kind of fun. Okay, I just want to check and see if there's any Pokemon around right now. Let's take.
Why is Pokemon better now? I just recall throwing a ball.
Oh yeah, it's gotten much more, right? So you can have friends now, right, Jessica?
Ooh, yeah, you can have share. Friends now. What a concept!
You can share.
It's
stuff.
Very exciting. Yeah, it and is. It's going to link up with the new games too, with the
Harry Potter
Pokemon.
Game. Oh, with the actual Pokemon.
With the actual, yeah, the Harry Potter game was a real disappointment for me.
Oh, you played it already?
Yeah, I love Harry Potter. I have a few tattoos, but...
Oh, let me see. What do you got? What do you
it
got?
It was a little... I have the Marauders
Hagar?
Map.
Oh, look at that.
I can't...
You have a Marauders map on you.
Yeah, that part right
Holy
there.
Cow.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
That's really cool. So, you played the one that Niantic is that's based.
Oh, not that one. Yeah, I'm excited about that one.
Niantic is going to white label the platform, and I heard the first one's going to be a Fantastical Beasts Pokemon style game. Where you
yeah, it'll be a Harry Potter one, which it sounds like everything I've ever wanted, so I'm very excited.
Yeah, you won't hear from me for a few weeks. Oh, look, an Archaeopteryx. I'm sorry, an Aerodactyl in Pokemon. Nice. Yeah. Ooh. Oh, Jessica.
Oh.
It's 1557.
Good luck.
Oh, I'm gonna give it a couple of berries. I'm gonna use my Ultra Ball. Oop. Come on, baby. Come on. I want you, Aerodactyl. Oh, so tough.
While do you play with AR on or off?
Off.
Okay, good.
Yeah, the AR is terrible.
It is. I'm just
even on the iPhone 10 because they have an advanced AR mode now.
Mm-hmm.
It's really awful.
It's bad. No one uses it.
It puts these Pokemon on people's shoulders and stuff. And anyway,
maybe we'll get 9 camera lenses. It'll be better.
Yeah. Our show today. Oh crap! It got away. Our show today brought to you by ZipRecruiter. If you're hiring, ZipRecruiter's revolutionized how you do it with technology. It's kind of amazing. One of the things I love about ZipRecruiter is, you know, first of all, and we've talked about this a lot, when you've got an opening, instead of figuring out what job board to go to, you just go to ZipRecruiter.com, post it there. Actually, while you're doing it, go to ZipRecruiter.com/twit for me. Post it there, and you're already posting to 100-plus job sites, including social networks like Twitter and Facebook. I mean, you're getting it out everywhere. But even better than that, ZipRecruiter actually brings people to you. They build a platform that finds the right job candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for and identifies people with the right experience and then says, hey, here's a job you ought to apply for. This is we did it the other day. We were looking for a new bookkeeper. This was wild. We tried it two ways. We had a headhunter and then we tried ZipRecruiter. Literally, Lisa posted it within about an hour. These candidates are coming. She says, wow, these are really good. Even better. 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. And unlike a headhunter, not only is it faster, it's better, and it's a lot less expensive. In fact, it's free right now when you go to ZipRecruiter.com/twit. They even highlight the strongest applications in the ZipRecruiter interface. No more calls to your phone or emails to your inbox. It all goes into ZipRecruiter. They format the resume so it's easy to read them. We were blown away. We were really blown away. ZipRecruiter really works. ZipRecruiter.com/twit. We use it. Some of the biggest companies in the world use it. And now you can use it free at ZipRecruiter.com/twit. They call it the smartest way to hire. ZipRecruiter.com/twit. All right. I'm going to give up on that Aerodactyl. What kind of companion do you walk around with? That's another thing they added. You walk around with your companion Pokemon. I have I am very proud of my albino Ninetales.
Ooh.
I know. Special creature. I know.
I had a Zubat for a very long time. Probably my favorite.
Yeah. They're cute.
Yeah. I like bats.
I evolved my Zubat to a Golbat, but I don't know what the Golbat turns into because I can't get enough Zubat candy. Okay, that's enough of that. Let's move on. God, did I miss anything? Are there other stories? Because there seems like we had many, and I don't know if I've hit them all.
I really, really want you to end with the Reddit banning half of their...
Thanos.
So do something else, but please end with
that. No, I'm going to end with that right now. Let's go home.
Okay.
I know Westworld's over, but there's something on HBO tonight, I'm sure. So did you do this, Brian?
I didn't have time to sign up. Like, that's one of the things is everybody tried to sign up and join the subreddit so that they could possibly be banned, and I didn't make it in time.
The subreddit was Thanos did nothing wrong. It was a, you know, Infinity War thing.
Hey, by the way, you might want to spoiler alert people.
Okay.
There's no way to describe what we're going to describe.
Well, no, we don't have to refer to the movie, but it would be, if you haven't seen the movie, God knows why you haven't, but if you haven't seen the movie... By the way, if you haven't seen it by now, don't.
It's not very good.
It's not that good. It's a mishmash because they had every freaking character in it. There's some good moments, but this might spoil the end. But so they made a subreddit called Thanos Did Nothing Wrong. And see, by the way, Brian, you not only had to subscribe to it, you had to create a post.
Oh, okay. I wouldn't have had time.
Yeah. So I did that and I said, I don't feel so good. I was told that was the appropriate post. And then the very next day, which was, I don't remember what day they did this, they decided to kill half of all the subscribers in the post, which if you've seen the movie makes sense. I survived. Everybody who got banned was supposed to join a Soulstone subreddit for the poor people who got absorbed into the light. But apparently, there's a lot of pissed off people. There's still 557,000 subscribers. A lot of the people did not do what they were supposed to do. They're just sitting there banned. How do you know if you're banned? Because you can't post, right?
Yeah, I think it tells you it's like you can't access this Reddit or whatever.
Yeah, so I'm not banned. I survived. I'm one of the lucky.
But you know, did it teach you anything about morality or humanity or existence?
Yeah,
I think that was the goal, right?
It's good to be the king.
Leo,
you were talking earlier about how, you know, what people thought of the web would be, the early web and the promise of the early web.
Yeah.
Doesn't this remind you of like sort of the web when it was good?
Yeah.
Because it's like all the users banding together to make an elaborate joke happen. And also what I loved about it is that Reddit, they contacted Reddit. Reddit got on board. They wanted to do this before July 4th or the week of July 4th. And Reddit says to them, well, you know, our engineers are going to be on vacation. So can we, you know, so I love the whole thing. Like this is why I loved the web when I was growing up, like for this kind of stuff.
Absolutely. This is the Cambridge teapot writ large. They actually, to throw in another thing, they on Twitch, they did a live stream of the banning. So you could watch the names scroll by as they were banned. It was really, I completely agree with you, Brian. This is why God gave us the internet, for stuff like this. No, it's fun. It's just dumb. It was silly. There was no point. But now there's no point in being in the Reddit because it's boring.
I was curious about that. Like, so if this was a vibrant community, is now one of those Soulstone communities now the vibrant subreddit?
Ah, I don't know. They won't let me in.
Oh, you've been banned.
Banned from Soulstone. I don't know. Did I learn anything from this? No, I don't think so. I think the best thing you could say is what Brian said. It's kind of a fun idea that 500,000 people would pull together to create this kind of strange, meaningless joke. There were a lot of S posts, a lot of bad meme posts. And I guess if you really want to see a lot of bad Thanos memes, you could still go there. The funniest thing was that Thanos posted. Mm-hmm. he posted a thing and snapped his fingers. Not Thanos himself, but
Josh Brolin, right?
The human they got to play Thanos. Josh Brolin. Yes, I think we can end with that. I think you're right, Brian McCullough. And I will now end the show. You ready? No, wait a minute. I need my glove.
Wait, you have to make two of them disappear, kind of like in a movie.
Soul stones. Yeah, we can do that. Wait a minute.
Yeah, because we're on the screens. You can just turn off our screen.
Half of you. But there's, and there are four of us. Before we do that, let me thank Brian X. Chen from the New York Times for being here.
Pleasure to be here. Great.
I appreciate that you come up for it. He's lead consumer technology writer in the New York Times. Give Sophie my best.
Best kid. She's, me, not so much.
She was good to put up with you, I have to say. Uncle Brian's limiting my phone usage again.
But she got an iPhone 10 out of it.
Did she get to keep it?
Probably not.
No.
I'll get it back.
Yeah. Anything you want to mention or plug? Anything coming up?
My Twitter handle is BXChen if you want to follow me. I tweet about my stories and other stuff about tech and the New York Times in general. So.
Does the Times, I know sometimes papers treat your personal Twitter account as like they're almost their property. Does the Times have restrictions on what you can do?
We have an ethics policy. You know, you should represent the Times. You shouldn't, you know, be showing biases or use very many curse words and that kind of thing. There's like standards, you know. Yeah. But they're pretty loose about it. It's not too strict.
Yeah. Because it is your kind of your personal.
Yeah, they want you to have a voice, that kind of thing.
That's the key.
But I don't tend to post that frequently just because I don't really feel like I have that much to say. So, you know.
You did tweet about rage quitting Fortnite, though.
I did. Oh, it was infuriating.
Brian McCullough, he is the host of a must-listen-to podcast every evening, 5 p.m. Eastern, the Tech Meme Ride Home. Brian MCC on Twitter. Anything you'd like to say?
Well, do subscribe to the Tech Meme Ride Home and let me shout headlines in your ear every day. But we're getting close enough. My book is coming out in October. It's called How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone, How the Internet Happened. So pre-order that if you feel inclined.
Oh, and Carson, let's book him on Triangulation so we can talk about it.
We've already talked about that.
Oh,
yeah.
Nice. That's great. Jessica, how bad was it? Was it okay hanging out with us geeks?
This was absolutely wonderful. Awesome. I feel at home.
Yay, you are at home. Jessica Condit, come back soon. She's senior editor at Engadget. Do you do any other podcasts?
Whenever people ask me if I write an interesting story, I'll usually get hit up and I'll tweet about it.
You don't have one of your own, the Jessica podcast?
Not yet. I really want one. So I'm working a few angles right now. We'll see in the future.
I think you should have one. That's my
I'd
thought.
Like it, yeah.
Yeah. Great to have you. Thanks for joining us. We do Twit Sunday afternoons, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time, 2200 UTC. If you want to watch live, you can at twit.tv/live. That's actually our page that links then to all the other streams, including a couple of audio streams as well as video streams, so you could pick the way you want to watch it. If you do watch the live stream, it would be great if you go in the chat room, because that's where the audience gets to yell back at us. It's irc.twit.tv. You could do it on the web or use your own IRC client. You could also join us in the studio. We had a great studio audience today. Thank you all for joining us. Just email tickets at twit.tv. Let us know you're coming. We'll put a chair out for you. If you can't watch live or stream it live, you can always get on-demand versions of everything we do at our website, twit.tv, twit.tv. Or subscribe. You know, every podcast application will have Twit. We've been doing this quite a while now, since 2005, so they've all figured it out. Subscribe to the podcast. That way you'll get it the minute the show's available, late Sunday afternoon, early Sunday evening. It also works, I should mention, to listen to us on your voice-enabled device, whether it's an Amazon Echo or Google Home, a Siri, a HomePod, or even that Cortana thing that Harman Kardon made. In most cases, just say, listen to Twit. And you'll hear us. Sometimes you have to say, listen to Twit on TuneIn. Not sure why that happens, but that's sometimes another way to do it. Or any of our shows. Thanks for being here. We'll see you later. Now, you ready? I've got my Soul Stone glove. Another Twit is in the can.
Doing the Twit.
Doing the Twit. Nothing happened. Half the audience disappeared. Oh, they're gone! We survived, Brian!
Oh, my God!
Yeah!